And welcome to this LexisNexis webinar entitled The Latest Tax Cases 2020. By way of introduction, I'm Hugh Gunson, a legal director and head of tax disputes and investigations at Charles Russell Speechleys. And I'm joined today by Hartley Foster, partner and head of tax disputes at Field Fisher. We're going to talk to you today about a selection of what we think are the most relevant and interesting tax cases currently going through the courts. We're going to speak about six cases across a diverse range of topics, covering many different taxes and both substantive tax and procedural points. We hope you enjoy it. So I'm going to begin by speaking about the Court of Appeal decision in Jimenez and HMRC. Actually, a decision from last year, but it is an important one and is going up to the Supreme Court at some point soon. So the background to this case is a tax investigation into a UK national living in Dubai. The principal issue in the investigation related to Mr. Jimenez's tax residence. Key point for the case is that HMRC issued Mr. Jimenez with an information notice under Schedule 36 of the Finance Act 2008 at his address in Dubai, requiring various information, including details of his own bank accounts and credit card accounts, and a schedule of his visits to the UK for the period from 2004 to 2013. Just by way of background, under Schedule 36 of the Finance Act 2008, HMRC have the power to issue a notice to a taxpayer, requiring them to provide information or documents that are reasonably required for the purposes of checking their tax position. HMRC can also issue notices to third parties, but as the law currently stands, only with taxpayer agreement or tribunal approval. And the regime contains various limitations and exclusions on HMRC powers. Most obviously and most importantly, HMRC are not allowed to use these powers to obtain privileged material. In the present case, the information notice was originally approved by the first tier tribunal after the revenue sought such approval. And the taxpayer challenged, by way of judicial review, that information notice on the grounds that an information notice of this type could not be issued extraterritorially. The High Court had originally found the notice could not be issued extraterritorially, i.e. outside the UK, and the revenue appealed. So it came up to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal decided that a Schedule 36 taxpayer notice could in fact be issued outside of the UK. The court engaged in a general and discussion in general about the territoriality of UK legislation. In short, there is a general presumption that UK legislation does not have extraterritorial effect, but that does not prevent a particular piece of legislation from having extraterritorial effect if the context so requires. What's really involved is a question of construction of the statute in question by reference to its language and purpose in the context of the principles of international law. Relevant principles for this case were the overriding purpose of Schedule 36, which was to give HMRC investigatory powers to verify a taxpayer's self-assessment. Many of the relevant taxes can be imposed on persons outside the UK, say, for example, income tax charged on UK income of a non-resident, CGT can apply to a disposal by a non-resident of UK property, SDLT can be chargeable on the acquisition of UK property by a non-resident, and so on. In that context, it was found to be unlikely for the powers in Schedule 36 to be limited to the UK. There was also no territorial limitation in the words of the statute. And a further overriding purpose of the legislation was that there was an obvious public interest in allowing the revenue to collect information cross-border to prevent cross-border tax evasion and the like. The court also considered two relevant principles of international law. First, that non-compliance with the notice was not a criminal offence. So the general presumption that statute does not make conduct of all criminal was not in point. Penalties for failure to provide the information requested purely civil. And HMRC did not suggest that those could be directly enforced in a foreign state. But for example, a taxpayer may hold assets in the UK against which the revenue could enforce. Further, sending of the notice abroad was found not to contravene the UK's international obligations. It did not require the performance of an official act abroad. Rather, all it required Mr. Jimenez to do was to provide the information and documents to HMRC in the UK as part of their investigation of his self-assessment. In contrast, HMRC accepted that another power within Schedule 36, so for example, the right to inspect business premises, would involve the performance of an official act abroad, and so would contravene the UK's international obligations, therefore could only be issued in the UK. Taking all of those points together, the Court of Appeal held that the information notice could be issued outside the jurisdiction to Mr. Jimenez in Dubai.
Do you consider that the Court of Appeal's approach means that Schedule 36 now cuts across the existing treaty-based system for requesting information of non-UK persons?
I think to a certain extent it does. I think it's fair to say that the prevailing view before the Court of Appeal's decision in Jimenez was that Schedule 36, revenue couldn't exercise their Schedule 36 powers abroad, and that if HMRC wanted to request information from non-residents, they needed to use the various international treaties and conventions that you've mentioned. In some senses, that view of the world worked and fitted together quite nicely. The Court of Appeals decision does rather throw that into doubt and creates significant overlap. But I suppose that overlap is only to the benefit of HMRC in terms of giving them greater power and potentially a choice to pursue one of two different routes. So where does that leave us? The taxpayer has been granted permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. As far as I'm aware, the hearing date is still awaited. It's worth noting also that subsequent to the Court of Appeal's decision, the First Tier Tribunal has applied the same reasoning to a third party notice in a case called PQ and HMRC that's referenced on the slide. There, the tribunal held that third party notices can also be issued abroad where there is a sufficient connection between the intended recipient and the information sought to be obtained. Overall, I think this decision has potentially significant consequences. In recent years, HMRC have been given much greater information gathering rights and powers, and also more powers in general terms that are exercisable outside the jurisdiction. This decision is only a further boost to the suite of weapons in their armoury. In recent years, they have become more and more fond of issuing Schedule 36 notices, and the decision will only encourage them to do so, and in particular to continue to do so overseas. It also means that for an overseas person, as I've alluded to already, HMRC don't need to make requests to the home state under the various double tax treaties, information exchange agreements and conventions that exist for the purposes of sharing information cross-border. Rather, revenue now have the power to go directly to the overseas taxpayer or relevant person. The upshot of that is likely to be that the information gathering process will be much quicker. There is also potentially a significant impact on residents of, say, offshore jurisdictions where there is no or limited information exchange treaties or conventions, trust companies, for example, where HMRC may previously have struggled to find the right means of getting information within a reasonable time frame. They can now go direct to source, i.e. to the taxpayer relevant person themselves.
What is your prediction in respect to the Supreme Court's approach?
I think it's quite a finely balanced one, but despite what I've said earlier, my inclination is that the Supreme Court will in fact uphold the Court of Appeals approach. Elements of the Court of Appeals reasoning, while perhaps surprising at the time, do actually read quite persuasively. I think in particular the points around the public interest in combating international tax evasion may well find favour with the Supreme Court, particularly in the current climate.
Thank you very much. The first case that I would like to talk about today is the ZipVit case, which has gone from the First Tier Tribunal, through the Upper Tribunal, through to the Court of Appeal, then to the Supreme Court, and finally a reference has been made to the Court of Justice, and then it will, in due course, return to the Supreme Court. So if I just start by looking at the background facts in relation to this. The first aspect of this is the legal basis, and that is Article 1321A of the Principal VAT Directive. That article provides an exemption for the Universal Postal Service, and this is in effect for the public policy reason of ensuring that there is a postal service provided so that it costs the same amount of money to send a letter from an address 1 to address 2 in London as to sending it to the Orkneys, for example, notwithstanding the very significant difference in cost between those two deliveries. Zipfit was a fully taxable business, and it supplied vitamins and minerals to its customers, and that was supplied by mail order, and it used the Royal Mail to provide those services. When those services were made, Royal Mail and HM Revenue and Customs, and also Zipfit, considered that those supplies were exempt from VAT, in accordance with the general understanding of the exemption for the Universal Postal Service. Accordingly, no invoices that included amounts of VAT were issued by Royal Mail to Zipfit. In 2009, there was a challenge by effectively a rival organisation, the courier company TNT, to the VAT exemption for the Universal Postal Service. And that challenge was taken to the European Court of Justice. The decision of the court was that, whilst it was correct that there was an exemption, that exemption does not apply to supplies for which the terms have been individually negotiated. And just pausing there, that would apply in relation to the Zipfit supplies. Those terms were individually negotiated. So as a consequence of the decision of the European Court of Justice in the TNT case, UK VAT law was amended, and was amended with effect on the 31st of January 2011. And that the relevant legislation is Group 3, Schedule 9 of the VAT Act. Following the decision of the TNT case, Zipfit sought to recover from HMRC as input tax the output tax which Royal Mail should have accounted to HMRC for on the supplies that it made to Zipfit, but did not. Zipfit made claims primarily for the period March 2006 to June 2009. So these were claims for the period before the change in the UK in the law and before the TNT claim. HMRC, perhaps unsurprisingly, refused those claims, and the matter went to the tribunal. And before the tribunal, there were three arguments that were in play, and I'm going to analyse each of these arguments in turn. The first of these arguments can be dealt with comparatively quickly. It was addressed only at the first tier tribunal stage, and it was no longer an issue beyond that stage. The first argument is in terms of a conforming interpretation of UK law. And Zipfit said that the postal exemption must be interpreted so as to achieve the purpose of the principle VAT directive. And so it must take account of the European Court of Justice's decision in the TNT case, which sets out how that provision is to be interpreted. And the relevant case is a very well-known case, Mar Leasing. The case citation is in the slides, but it's case C106-89. And the First Tier Tribunal agreed with Zipfit in relation to that. It said a conforming construction must be adopted. So the supplies were, when they were made, standard rated as a matter of UK law, i.e. the UK law had to be interpreted in accordance with the TNT decision. In any event, albeit it's obiter, Zipfit could rely on the direct effect of the principle of that directive, and that would be to the same end. And an example of a case of when that was done is the Becker case. The reference is C881. The second argument, which is a much more difficult argument, is the question as to whether or not there was VAT, quote, due from or paid by Zipfit within the meaning of Article 168A of the Principal VAT Directive. Zipfit's case was quite simple. It said Zitfit paid Royal Mail the contract price. The supply was standard rated as a matter of UK law, and that's the conforming interpretation of it. Therefore, an appropriate percentage of the price that was paid to Royal Mail must have comprised VAT. That was resisted by HMRC. The tribunal went for a slightly unusual approach, which was that after the hearing had concluded, it decided to address this issue and conclude this issue on a basis that hadn't been argued by either party at the tribunal. Even more unusually, it didn't ask either party to provide submissions in relation to the tribunal's own analysis of the question. And what the tribunal said is actually, the parties have addressed the wrong question, or alternatively, they have addressed the wrong entity. In fact, the issue is whether VAT was due or paid by Royal Mail, i.e. not due from or paid by Zitfit. And clearly, it was common ground that VAT was not paid to HMRC by Royal Mail. So the question then is, well, was it due? And the tribunal, and again, this is its own analysis, said no. There was no enforceable tax claim against Royal Mail. The VAT was not declared by Royal Mail either in its VAT returns or in a voluntary disclosure. Royal Mail had not issued any invoices showing the VAT as due, nor had HMRC assessed Royal Mail, and in any event, it would have been out of time to do so. So in relation to the second argument, albeit on its own analysis, the tribunal concluded that VAT was not due from or paid, so that Zitfit was unsuccessful with regard to the second question. The third argument that arose was the question as to whether or not there was a VAT invoice. And clearly there wasn't. It was established that the invoices didn't have VAT. All parties were working on the assumption that there was no VAT on the supplies at the relevant time. However, there is an alternative route if a taxpayer doesn't have a VAT invoice. And the relevant legislation, the European legislation first, is Article 180 of the Principal VAT Directive. And that provides that member states may authorize a taxable person to make a deduction which he has not made in accordance with Articles 178 and 179. European legislation has been implemented in the UK by Regulation 29.2 of the VAT Regulations 1995. And Regulation 29 provides that a taxpayer, quote, shall hold or provide such other evidence of the charge to VAT as HMRC may direct, unquote. So Regulation 29 gives HMRC a discretion to allow a VAT claim where no VAT invoice is held by the taxpayer. Perhaps not too surprisingly, in this instance, HMRC refused to exercise the discretion to allow Zitfit to make a claim without holding a VAT invoice. And the issue that was before the tribunal was whether that refusal by HMRC was reasonable. And in analysing that question, the tribunal said that economic burden is relevant. We're in a situation here where Zitfit did not bear the burden of the VAT. It responded by saying, in effect, well, that's not really the question. HMRC should have, and certainly at one stage, could have sought to recover the tax from Royal Mail. And the tribunal concluded that point by saying that there was no evidence before it that would enable it to determine the point. Ultimately, the tribunal concluded that HMRC's decision not to accept alternative evidence could not be impugned, And I just refer to paragraph 195 of the tribunal's decision to provide a flavour in terms of how the tribunal approached this. It said, why should HMRC pay a refund out of public funds where it is not legally obliged to do so, and such repayment would represent a windfall for Zipfit rather than compensation for a real loss? Perhaps understandably, Zipfit appealed that decision to the Upper Tribunal. At the Upper Tribunal, there were two issues to be determined. As I said, the conforming interpretation issue had been addressed, and that was not taken on appeal. So the two issues were due and paid and the issue of the invoices. In relation to the due and paid points, both HMRC and Zipfit submitted that the first-tier tribunal was wrong in saying that the VAT due or paid means due or paid by the supplier. Their position was that it means due or paid by the customer. And there is a relevant case, which is PPUH Stechem. The reference is case C277/14. The Upper Tribunal agreed in relation to this. As a matter of European law, that is quite clearly the correct approach. It was somewhat critical and said the first tier tribunal plainly went off on a frolic of its own in deciding otherwise. So clearly HMRC and Zipfit were asking the right question, and there was a question that needed to be determined. Again, Zipfit's case was it had paid Royal Mail the contract price, and the supply was in law standard rated. Therefore, the price paid must have included the VAT. HMRC raised two arguments. First of all, that it's the contract itself that determines whether or not VAT is included in the price. And certainly at this stage, there was little evidence as to what the contracts actually said as between Royal Mail and Zipfit. And again, it focused on the fact that Zipfit had not borne the economic burden of VAT. The Upper Tribunal slightly dodged the point and said, well, on balance, we prefer Zipfit's argument. However, the question is academic only because of the decision which we have reached in relation to the invoice issue. And in relation to invoices, again, the question is whether or not HMRC's refusal to accept its discretion under Regulation 29 was reasonable, was the question that needed to be answered. And the Upper Tribunal said that HMRC was entitled to consider why a VAT invoice was not held by Zipfit. The situation was that Zipfit did not bear the economic burden of the VAT, yet it claimed that it must be treated in effect as if it had paid that VAT. And it noted also that the Royal Mail priced its services to include the VAT on imports, which it could not recover as its services were exempt. So on that basis, it concluded also that HMRC were entitled not to exercise their discretion to allow Zipfit to make a claim by alternative evidence. The matter proceeded to the Court of Appeal. And before the Court of Appeal, before we actually got onto the legal arguments, the Court of Appeal insisted that the facts be revisited, and in particular the contractual position as between Zipfit and the Royal Mail. It noted that there were few contractual documents put before the First Tier Tribunal, and it said that there were three possibilities regarding the contracts. Either the parties agreed that they were exclusive of VAT, or they agreed they were inclusive of VAT, or alternatively, they were simply silent. And that was a point that the Coles Bill considered was very important in terms of analysing what had happened. And so it directed the parties to undertake an investigation into the underlying factual position as regards the obligations of ZipFit under its contract with Royal Mail. After having fully investigated, there was then a debate before the Court of Appeal as to whether it should allow findings of fact to be made, having considered the new evidence. It referred to the well-known case Loudon-Marshall, which sets out the principles to be addressed when an appellate court is looking at new evidence. And the Court of Appeal concluded that, in accordance with the overriding objective of doing justice, it should look at this material. And the general terms, there were various versions, but in the general terms primarily provided that the contract was exclusive of VAT. Therefore, Royal Mail could recover the output VAT from ZipFit. However, the Court of Appeal was aware that ZipFit is a test case, and there are many other cases waiting in the wings in relation to this. Estimates of tax are in the range of £1 billion. And given that, given the significance of these matters, and because it was a test case, the Court of Appeal decided to look at the due and paid issue on two alternative bases. And the first basis was the situation which actually was there, which is that Royal Mail had a contractual right to recover from ZipFit an amount equivalent to the VAT, but had taken no steps to enforce that right. And the Court of Appeal's view was that in those circumstances, a reference would be needed to determine whether ZipFit is entitled to claim a deduction for the VAT element of the original purchase price, on the footing that it must now be treated as inclusive of VAT. And then moving on to the alternative scenario, the Court of Appeal indicated that that had been decided. And that was in the situation where Royal Mail had no contractual right. And if that was the case, then it was clear the answer is a matter of European law. The Tulika case, which is case C249/12, determines that the price paid for each supply must be treated as VAT inclusive. On that basis, since ZipFit had paid the original invoice prices of the supplies in full, it has paid the VAT element contained in those prices. However, the invoice issue meant that no reference was required to be, or the Court of Appeal determined that no reference was required to be made to the European Court of Justice. With regard to the invoice issue, ZipFit argued that the existing invoices should have been treated as defective invoices by HMRC, and then argued that those defects were corrected post-TNT. And on that basis, it should have exercised its discretion to allow the invoices be treated effectively as alternative evidence and to allow its claim to be made. The Court of Appeal said no, that is in fact a recharacterization of the original payment. And it looked again in terms of the financial position. The Court of Appeal said there was an obvious detriment to HMRC and to the public purse if ZipFit is able to obtain a deduction without first showing that the tax in question had been paid to HMRC by Royal Mail. And I'll just read out a passage. It's paragraph 116, again, to give a flavour of the Court of Appeal's approach to ZipFit's claim. A retrospective recharacterization of sums originally paid on the footing that the supplies in question were exempt would now yield an uncovenanted bonus to ZipFit, generated by nothing more than ZipFit's unilateral decision to treat the amounts originally paid as VAT inclusive. It would, I think, be offensive to most people's sense of fiscal justice if a mechanical accounting exercise of this nature were permitted to generate a very substantial input tax credit in circumstances where, for whatever reason, none of the tax in question has been paid by the supplier. And so again, the Court of Appeal decided against Zipfit and in favour of HMRC. Having heard argument, the Supreme Court decided that neither issue was act clair, and it determined accordingly, as a court of final instance, that a reference needed to be made to the European Court of Justice. And the reference that it sent is clearly, in my view, put in a particular way as to the answers that it wants. And I'll just read out the reference that was made. There were four questions. The first question is, where HMRC, the Royal Mail, and Zipfit treat a standard rated supply as exempt, the contract states that the price was exclusive of VAT, and that if VAT were due, Zipfit should bear the cost of it. Royal Mail never claims the additional VAT due, and HMRC cannot claim from Royal Mail the VAT. Is the effect of the principle of that directive that the price actually paid is the combination of a net chargeable amount plus VAT, so that Zipfit can claim to deduct the input tax as VAT paid? The second question is, alternatively, can Zipfit claim to deduct input tax as VAT due? The third question, if Zipfit is unable to produce a VAT invoice in these circumstances, is it entitled to claim to deduct input tax? And the fourth question, in my view, this is an attempt to steer the Court of Justice in a particular direction. The fourth question is, in answering these questions, A, is it relevant to investigate whether Royal Mail would have a defence to any attempt by HMRC to issue an assessment? And B, is it relevant that Zipfit knew that the supply was not exempt and could have offered to pay the VAT so that it could be passed on to HMRC, but did not? And those matters have been sent to the European Court of Justice. It will issue, there'll almost certainly be an Advocate General's opinion, and then in due course it will release its decision. Whether that decision is in fact binding on the Supreme Court will depend as to when the decision is released. The current understanding is that we are leaving, or the transitional period will end at the end of this year. As a consequence of that, if the decision of the European Court of Justice is released after then, the Supreme Court will not be bound in the way that it would have been before by the European Court's decision. It undoubtedly will take it into account, but it won't be bound. So all I can say in summary in relation to Zipfit is watch this space. Thank you.
Thanks, Hartley. I'm now going to talk about the recent decision of the Upper Tribunal in Professional Game Match Officials Limited. This concerns a very hot topic at the moment, namely employment versus self-employment status, and in particular, the relevance of mutuality of obligation to that. This case concerned whether football referees, by which I mean national group referees, so primarily referees who referee in League One or League Two, and not Premier League referees, were employed or self-employed, and therefore, consequently, whether PGMOL, the company that engaged them, was liable to PAYE on payments made to the referees. At the first tier tribunal, it had been found that the referees were in fact self-employed, and the revenue appealed that decision to the upper tribunal. The contractual background is very relevant here. In short, sort of cutting through the detailed findings of fact of the first tier tribunal, there was an overarching contract between PGMOL and the refs covering their engagement together as a whole, if you like. But there was also a separate contract for each match appointment. So the way the system worked broadly is that match appointments were offered to referees via a centralized appointment system. It was up to the referee to accept any particular match appointment, and there was no sanction if the appointment wasn't fulfilled. Even once the referees had accepted, they were able to pull out at any time prior to the match. Similarly, PDMOL could cancel the appointment without any breach of contract. If that happened, the referee simply wouldn't get paid. Another key point that's worth noting, again from the FTT findings, is that the referees were dedicated, hard-working individuals who did it in large part for the love of the game. Typically, they were part-time and they had other full-time employment.
Does it matter that they are not refereeing for the money?
I think the fact that the referees were not, what they weren't refereeing for the money is very relevant to the overall factual matrix, which of course is central to any determination of employment status. And that particular aspect is part of what makes this case quite an unusual one. The first tier tribunal had placed a fair amount of reliance on this aspect when testing whether the terms of the contract matched up with commercial reality. The first tier tribunal found it did, and the upper tribunal ultimately said that the first tier tribunal was entitled to make that finding. But my own personal view, I don't think the fact that the referees were doing it for the love of the game was actually in any way determinative on some of the points in the decision. The way in which the upper tribunal expresses a number of its conclusions, in particular on the relevance of mutuality of obligation, don't depend at all on that particular factual point. So as I've alluded to already, the question was whether the referees were employees of PGMOL, such that PGMOL should have operated PAYE on payments made to them. By way of brief recap or background, for there to be an employment relationship as opposed to a self-employment relationship, there are three conditions that need to be satisfied. And these are set out classically in a case called Ready Mixed Concrete. First, the worker must agree to provide his or her own work in performing some service or remuneration. That is commonly referred to as mutuality of obligation. Second, there must be control by the putative employer. The worker must agree expressly or impliedly that he will be subject to the other's control in a sufficient degree. And thirdly, the other provisions of the contract must be consistent with an employment relationship. The issue here is mainly focused on mutuality of obligation, which is a very hot topic in today's labour market. The revenue argued that mutuality of obligation is only relevant to the basic question of whether a contract exists. And if there is a contract, whether it contains an obligation to provide services personally and obligations which are in some way work-related, and not more generally to the question of whether the contract is one of employment or one of self-employment. The upper tribunal disagreed with the revenue's argument. It found that mutuality of obligation is an essential requirement in the characterisation of a relationship as an employment contract. It's relevant to Limb 3 as well as Limb 1 of the test I referred to. For mutuality of obligation to exist, the upper tribunal found there were three things that needed to be satisfied. First, the employee must be required to do some work, must be required to do that work personally. Second, the employer must be required to provide work or a retainer in its absence. The upper tribunal said it was insufficient for there to be an employment contract if the only obligation on the employer was to pay for work as and when it's done. And thirdly, those obligations must subsist through the whole period of the contract. So applying those principles to the facts in PGMOL, there was an express term in the overarching contract. There was no obligation either on PGMOL to provide or in the referees to accept work. And this reflected the commercial reality, applying the principles in a case called Autoglens and Belcher. So on that basis, there was no mutuality of obligation by reference to the overall relationship. The referee found that there was some level of mutuality of obligation for the individual contracts, namely for the referee to officiate as contemplated unless he informed PGMOL that he could not, and relatedly for PGMOL to make payment for the work that was actually done, but that was not sufficient to render the individual match contract an employment contract. It was very relevant here that it could be cancelled by either party without breach. The upper tribunal also considered an argument by the revenue that PGMOL's acceptance that the referees were workers for employment law purposes was relevant. Brief background here. Employment law recognises a middle ground between employment and self-employment, i.e. worker status, where someone has some but not all the rights of an employee. There is no such concept for tax. For tax, you are either an employee or you are not. In any event, the Upper Tribunal said that this employment law status was not relevant for the tax, and in particular, worker status for employment law purposes can subsist without any obligation on the company or the employer to provide work, and that is specifically enshrined in the relevant employment statutes. Overall, therefore, the Upper Tribunal concluded that the First Tribunal was not wrong. There was no mutuality of obligation. The referees were not employees.
What do you consider is the minimum needed to establish mutuality of obligations?
That's a fair point, Hartley, but I think the short answer to that is no. I think HMRC probably should both amend the employment status manual and also factor this decision and its reasoning into the online check employment status for tax or CEST test. But in reality, I don't imagine that they will do either. The decision on mutuality of obligation was sufficient to win the case for the taxpayer. The Upper Tribunal went on to consider briefly the control element to the employment test. The First Tier Tribunal had found that PGMOL did not have sufficient control overall, taking into account various factors, including that PGMOL did not have even a theoretical right to step in during a match. The ultimate arbiter of the referees was the laws of the game of football. The Upper Tribunal disagreed with that, however. It said that the First Tier Tribunal had erred in saying there was not sufficient control because there was no right for PGMOL to step in during performance of the contract during a match. Case law shows that a practical limitation on ability and the ability to interfere in real time does not mean there is not sufficient control to show an employment relationship. Overall, that didn't necessarily mean there was sufficient control for there to be an employment relationship, but given its conclusion on mutuality of obligation, the Upper Tribunal declined to answer the point itself or remit it to the First Tier Tribunal for them to consider it further. So what are the implications of this decision? To my mind, they are potentially really quite significant indeed. The particular circumstances of this case, it must be admitted, were unusual, in particular the fact that the referees were passionate hobbyists. But the decision does, in my view, contain clear guidance on the nature and relevance of mutuality of obligation that is of wider application, i.e. the fact that it doesn't just go to the question whether there is a contract, but is also an essential point in the characterisation of a contract as one of employment or not. And that issue is very relevant in today's labour market, in particular the importance of the right to refuse work by the employee and the lack of obligation on the putative employer to provide it. In particular, one might think of the implications for the taxation of the gig economy and zero-hours contracts. It is worth noting also that the decision goes against the revenue's general approach to these matters, as is reflected in the way that they argue the case. It is now an upper tribunal decision, so it is now binding. It can't be dismissed as a non-binding First Tribunal decision as previously. The relevance of mutuality of obligation is a point the revenue often seek to downplay or dismiss in employment status disputes. So one might query whether any of those that are ongoing ought to be revisited in light of this case, or indeed, relatedly, whether any assessment of, for example, a contractor workforce as employees, whether in light of the upcoming IR35 reforms or in another context, again, ought to be revisited in light of the decision. Finally, I find the Upper Tribunal's observations on control are also potentially quite interesting, albeit it should be said that those observations were obiter and the Upper Tribunal did not ultimately reach any conclusion on the point. But the relative importance of the existence of an overall framework of control as compared to an actual right to step in during performance is potentially quite a significant one and may well have significant implications for the employment status assessment of a range of workers, particularly where you have skilled workers.
If I can ask two questions here, if I may, they are interrelated. First, do you know if HMRC are seeking to appeal the decision? And secondly, do you consider that the facts of this case are sufficiently unusual that HMRC will say that the Upper Tribunal's decision is in fact of little wide relevance?
I confess I don't personally know whether HMRC are seeking to appeal the decision. I suspect they might, but I guess we'll have to wait and see on that. I do agree the facts of the case are unusual, and I do suspect that HMRC will try to say that this is a case contained to its own facts. But as I've already alluded to, I don't think that's actually the right approach. I think in particular, some of the Upper Tribunal's reasoning on the relevance of mutuality of obligation and the circumstances in which there might not be sufficient mutuality of obligation for there to be an employment relationship are of broader, more general application and don't depend on the facts of this particular case.
The second case that I would like to talk to you about today is the Credit Suisse case and the recent decision of the First Tier Tribunal in relation to it. The Credit Suisse case concerned bank payroll tax. This was a temporary tax that was not enforced for a great deal of time. It was a temporary tax imposed by Schedule 1 Finance Act 2010 on certain forms of remuneration that were awarded to employees of banks during the period December 2009 and April 2010. Credit Suisse operated a deferred variable award scheme for senior employees that it called APA. That potentially fell within the remit of bank payroll tax. And so there were discussions about APA between HMRC and Credit Suisse, both before and after his bank payroll tax return was due to be filed. There was no agreement between the parties reached as to whether or not bank payroll tax applied to this particular scheme. Credit Suisse filed its return, and HMRC eventually, sometime after, concluded that, in its view, the awards made by Credit Suisse under the APA scheme were subject to bank payroll tax. And so it issued closure notices to Credit Suisse, increasing the tax payable to take account of the bank payroll tax by £83,144,379. But the question that arose was whether or not HMRC had in fact opened an inquiry into Credit Suisse bank payroll tax return. Credit Suisse indicated that its answer was no inquiry had been opened. It also argued that bank payroll tax did not apply to APA, and it submitted an appeal to the First Tier Tribunal. And it's worth noting, before we get into the main issue in the stay, is that the First Tier Tribunal concluded, albeit over to the reasons I'll come on to, that bank payroll tax did apply to APA. So the procedural issue before the First Tier Tribunal was whether or not HMRC had opened an inquiry into Credit Suisse's bank payroll tax return. And if we look at the relevant legislation first, it's paragraph 23, Schedule 1, Finance Act 2010. And that provides, one, HMRC may inquire into a bankroll tax return if they give notice to the taxable company of their intention to do so within the time allowed. Two, if the return was delivered on or before 31st August 2010, notice of inquiry may be given at any time on or before 31st August 2011. So I think there's two points to note from that. The first is the bank payroll tax notice of inquiry provisions are virtually identical to Section 9A, which for Tax Management Act pertaining to income tax, and paragraph 24, Schedule 18, Finance Act 1998, pertaining to corporation tax. All three require notice to be given, and all three have a strict time limit in order to do so. It's worth noting also that there is no prescribed form for an inquiry notice in the legislation. So if the revenue chose to, for example, write it in red ink on the side of a white cow, that would be absolutely fine, as purportedly happened in a sadly fictitious case, Board of Inland Revenue and Haddock. Before the First Tier Tribunal, HMRC went through the case law. There's quite considerable case law in relation to this point. It's reasonably uncontroversial, but I'll just summarize the key 6 points that HMRC emphasized. Point one is that giving notice means to intimate or to convey HMRC's intention to inquire. And that's the spring salmon case. There was some debate as to what is meant by intimate. In Scots law, that has a very specific meaning. It means to notify. That's not the case in English law, and it just bears its normal dictionary meaning. Secondly, as I've said, notice does not have to be in writing. There is no prescribed format, no specific wording, and also no formality is required. And that is the flags mode case. The third point, which is probably the most important point, is the question is, what would a reasonable taxpayer in Credit Suisse's position have understood from HMRC's communications? Would it have known that an inquiry had commenced? And that is the Wickersham case. Related to that, the fourth point, have HMRC sufficiently intimated or conveyed their intention? And that is the Mabbott case. Fifthly, notice must be clear, and that is the Raftapulu case. And sixthly, finally, the context is critical, and that is the case of Bristol and West. So those were the six principles in the cases which HMRC relied on. As I said, those were reasonably uncontroversial. So moving to the legal submissions put forward by HMRC in light of those principles established by the case law. Before the hearing, HMRC argued, first, notice of inquiry had been given orally at a meeting on the 2nd of November 2010. It's worth noting that that is notwithstanding HMRC manuals, particularly the bank payroll tax manual, indicating that notice of inquiry must be given in writing. However, if it had not been given orally at that meeting, then it had in fact been given by a different letter, and that was a letter dated the 15th of February 2011. Thirdly, if it hadn't been given by either of those two, then the whole of HMRC's correspondence and communications with Credit Suisse, quote, should be taken as a whole so far as giving notice is concerned. And it should be noted that in none of that correspondence or in the meeting notes was there any reference to inquiry. That was HMRC's position pre-hearing. On the first day of the hearing itself, HMRC took a slightly different position and it argued that there was in fact another letter, that was a notice. That was slightly problematic because it was contrary to its own witness evidence in relation to that. And the First Tier Tribunal commented at paragraph 198. For the first time, that officer's letter of 19th of August 2011 constituted a valid notice, was HMRC's case. It is worth noting that at no stage did it occur to the officer that his letter of the 19th of August 2011 constituted such a notice. In addition, the HMRC officer who carried out the statutory review did not apparently consider the letter of the 19th of August 2011 to be a notice of inquiry. I think it's fair to say that HMRC's case was not the strongest in relation to the evidence for the tribunal. So the First Tier Tribunal, first of all, set out its conclusions on the law, and it placed particular reliance on the Raftapulu case, which I have cited. And this set out six principles that apply. First, there is no prescribed form for an inquiry notice. Secondly, an inquiry notice must be understood by a reasonable taxpayer as giving notice of an intention to inquire into a return. Thirdly, The inquiry provisions suggest a procedure with some degree of formality and also suggest a procedure with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Fourthly, the opening of an inquiry has significant statutory consequences, including the right of HMRC to call for information and all documents. And as I've said previously, and the keep the reference, there is a one-year deadline for opening an inquiry, and that's common to both income tax, corporation tax, and bank payroll tax inquiries. Fifthly, paragraph 23, Schedule 1, Finance Act 2010, envisages that the notice will precede the inquiry, and it certainly will precede the closure of the inquiry. Sixthly, and this is an overall point, the notice precedes the inquiry, and it alerts the taxpayer to the start of a formal process with its attendant statutory powers that are available to HMRC. Next slide, please. It then went on to say that the words in paragraph 23.1 are plain English words. They have a straightforward meaning. Nonetheless, they must, of course, be construed purposively and in their statutory context. Having reviewed all the case law and having set out its analysis, the First Tier Tribunal said that a valid notice of inquiry under paragraph 23, and I would say same applies in relation to income tax and corporation tax, cannot be given as a matter of inference. And it concluded that HMRC's argument is simply inconsistent with the scheme of the legislation. Now, paragraph 196, the First Tier Tribunal said, HMRC's argument amounts, in short, to the proposition that if an officer merely proceeds to carry out an inquiry, i.e. engaging in a technical debate and requesting information, without giving the usual notice, a taxpayer ought in many cases to be able to infer from this inquiry process that in some manner a notice has been or is thereby being given. That is emphatically not what the statutory scheme envisages. If HMRC's argument is correct, it makes the requirement for an inquiry notice to be given almost redundant. On HMRC's case, the inquiry becomes the notice. That cannot be correct. First Tier Tribunal concluded, accordingly, that no inquiry had been opened by HMRC. And as a consequence of that, the £83 million old tax that arose on the basis that the tribunal accepted or concluded that bank payroll tax was due on April, but that £83 million could not be collected. And I think it's worth saying in conclusion in relation to this case is that HMRC's case was difficult, that even they seemed uncertain as to when they had given notice of their intention to inquire into Credit Suisse's tax returns certainly did not help matters. And it does seem that something slipped through the gap, and that is the consequence of HMRC's slip in this case.
Thanks again, Hartley. Now I'm going to talk about the recent Supreme Court decision in the case of Fowler, which is primarily about the application of deeming provisions in a tax treaty context, and as an aside, which I understand may have been the Supreme Court's first ever remote hearing. So the case of Fowler was a Supreme Court decision on the application of deeming provisions in a tax treaty context. To set out the facts in brief, the taxpayer was a deep sea diver. He was resident in South Africa, but did work in the UK as an employee. It was assumed that he was an employee for the purpose of this particular appeal. Under Section 15 of ETOIA, this sort of work done by employed divers is treated for income tax purposes as the carrying on of a trade in the UK. The question then was whether relief was available under the UK-South Africa Double Tax Treaty. Simplifying matters, the two relevant articles of the treaty that might have been in point were Article 14, Employment. Under that article, employment income, salaries, wages, and other remuneration, as the treaty refers to it, is taxed where it is earned, here, the UK. However, under Article 7, the business profits article, the earnings of a self-employed trade are taxed where the person is resident, here, South Africa, unless that trade is carried on through a UK permanent establishment. It was common ground here that there was no such UK permanent establishment. So if that was in point, the UK couldn't tax. It would be taxed in South Africa.
Could you please remind the viewers of the relevant principles that are to be applied when interpreting an international treaty?
Thanks, Hartley. As a general rule, when interpreting an international double tax treaty, first one must look at the clear words of the treaty, but there is caution against adopting a strictly literal interpretation. More regard should be had to the purpose of the treaty. And that purpose generally is to resolve issues of double taxation arising from the different tax systems of the two contracting countries. Any interpretation should take account of the fact that a treaty is an international rather than exclusively English instrument. And recourse can be had to various supplementary means of interpretation in the right context, including in particular the OECD commentaries. In short, the Supreme Court allowed HMRC's appeal. Taxpayers' income should be treated as employment income for double tax treaty purposes and therefore taxed in the UK. One of the key principles in their reasoning was that under Article 3.2 of the relevant double tax treaty, undefined terms used in the treaty must, unless the context otherwise requires, be given the meaning they have in the law of the state seeking to recover the tax. So here, the words of the treaty must be applied according to their meaning under English law. Key question was which of the two treaty provisions I referred to earlier applied, employment or business profits? The answer in this case depended on a true construction of the treaty articles, and in particular the meaning of the relevant terms that were used, those terms being profits, enterprise of the contracting state, salaries, wages and other remuneration, and employment. The Supreme Court said that the double tax treaty must be applied to the real world and not the fictional world of UK tax legislation, unless the deeming provision, i.e. Section 15 of TOIA, changes the meaning which the terms used in the double tax treaty would otherwise have. For that approach, they relied on various sections of the OECD commentary and the fact that the treaty is a bilateral international agreement. The Supreme Court noted that a deeming provision doesn't generally give a different meaning to the relevant terms, and nor did Section 15.2 of a TOIA in this case. What Section 15 of a TOIA does is it takes the usual meaning of the terms and creates a fiction. The Supreme Court noted in particular, relevant point here is to the focus on the exact words of the deeming, that what Section 15.2 used the word instead. So it's about income arising from employment, but instead provides that the income is, contrary to the fact, treated as the profits of a trade. The Supreme Court also considered the purpose of the particular deeming in Section 15.2 of TOIA. On this, it said, mainly, the purpose of that deeming is not to decide whether divers are taxed in the UK on their employment income. Rather, it is to adjust how that income is taxed, and specifically by allowing a more generous regime for the deduction of expenses. Divers in this line of work generally incur their own, frequently significant, costs. And so the other aspect of the purpose was that it wasn't to render divers immune from UK tax. Such a result would be anomalous and contrary to the purpose of the treaty. Overall, taking all that into consideration, the Supreme Court allowed HMRC's appeal. The employment income article of the treaty applied, and the income was taxed in the UK. It's worth pausing briefly to consider the implications of the decision. The particular application of that treaty to divers is clearly itself quite a narrow point, but it goes without saying there are a number of deeming provisions in the UK tax code, and so the ramifications could well be significant. As a very general comment, the Supreme Court decision does seem to set quite a high bar for deeming provisions to alter the meaning of terms in double tax treaties. To take a few examples, one type of deeming provision in the UK tax code are provisions that tax one type of receipt as something else, the provisions that tax capital gains as income, for example, offshore income gains or profits from deeply discounted securities. Applying the logic of the decision in Fowler, are they dealt with under the capital gains articles of the treaty? There are also deeming provisions which create deemed income where there is no real-world income or where the income of one party is deemed to arise to another. So, for example, the transfer of assets abroad code, settlements code, or the off-payroll working rules, or IR35. Again, we might wonder, what is the impact there? I think it's fair to say that there are no easy or general answers to these questions. The answer in each case will require a close analysis of the purpose of the particular deeming provision.
Can you comment, please, on the potential ramifications of the decision as regards IR35?
I think that's potentially quite a difficult question. IR35 treats an amount paid to an intermediary, which is typically a personal service company, for the services of a worker as employment income. So most obviously, if you've in an international context, if you've got a non-UK PSC and a non-UK worker, but a UK client and work being done in the UK, prima facie, the UK will try and tax that as employment income under IR35. However, the foreign jurisdiction, the jurisdiction where the worker and the PSC are resident, may try to tax it as business profits of the company. So immediately, it's possible to see the potential scope for double taxation. And the decision in Fowler might actually help the taxpayer in that sort of scenario. The real question will be whether the IR35 deeming is carried through so that for double tax treaty purposes, employment income includes deemed IR35 employment income. The question really is whether that is the purpose of the IR35 deeming. And I would have thought that the decision in Fowler suggests the answer to that may well be no. It would also be relevant there that it may also be relevant in the general context that the non-application of IR35 in such a context would in fact stop double taxation.
And the third and final case that I would like to talk about today is the Hanks case, which is a decision of the First Tier Tribunal. It may be subtitled, "Be careful what you wish for." In the Hanks case, if I start by just going through the background facts before analysing what was decided by the tribunal. So Mr. Hanks considered himself to be domiciled outside the UK. He filed his tax returns on the basis that he was entitled to be taxed, and he also elected to be taxed on the remittance basis. HMRC disagreed with that. They argued that he had obtained a UK domicile of choice. They opened inquiries into two tax returns, and that was in December 2016 and in November 2017. After the inquiries had been in progress for some 3 years, and Mr. Hanks considered that he had provided copious amounts of information to HMRC in relation to their inquiries, he applied for closure notices, seeking their inquiries to be closed so that matters could be drawn to a head. HMRC issued information notices. So there were two issues at live. The first was whether the information notices had been issued validly, and the second was whether it was reasonable for HMRC to keep the inquiries open. So the First Tier Tribunal proceedings concerned Mr. Hanks' appeal against the information notices and his application for closure notices. In that context of those proceedings, Mr. Hanks argued that the First Tier Tribunal could determine his domicile status at its hearing of those applications. And it's that particular point that I think is of considerable interest in relation to this case. At the tribunal, there was a jurisdictional issue raised first. This was, in fact, a minor issue, and it arose from some of the correspondence for the tribunal, which it's fair to say that there were some ambiguities in terms of how it was expressed, and in particular as to what the tribunal had directed with regard to the hearing of the applications. But in any event, HMRC that argued that it would be an abuse of process for Mr. Hanks' applications to proceed. They argued that the First Tier Tribunal had already ruled that the issue of his domicile could not be addressed in these proceedings. The First Tier Tribunal disagreed with that application by HMRC, it said that the correspondence was at its absolute highest ambiguous, and that it would deal with the matter. And so that was quite a minor issue. But the most important issue to be determined by the First Tribunal is what is the role of the First Tribunal in relation to applications such as this. And in particular, the First Tier Tribunal asks itself, is it entitled to determine the question of a person's domicile in the course of considering an application for a closures notice or an appeal against an information notice? And that was a question that the First Tier Tribunal had asked itself quite recently, and that was in the executors of Mrs. Levy case. And in that case, the First Tier Tribunal concluded no, they did not have the power to determine the question of domicile at this stage in the judicial process. Yeah, I'm not going to go into too much detail with regard to the Levy case, but in short, the primary reason for that particular tribunal reaching that conclusion was, at least in very large part, by reason of the doctrine of issue estoppel. And I will comment on issue estoppel a bit later. But in terms of whether or not that was the correct approach, this first-tier tribunal disagreed with that first-tier tribunal. It's worth noting that whilst first-tier tribunals will take note of other first-tier tribunal decisions, they are not bound by those decisions. And so the first-tier tribunal was entitled and did take a different stance in relation to effectively the same question. So the First Tier Tribunal then, in terms of looking in terms of as to whether or not it could do this, it looked at the Vodafone 2 case. And in Vodafone 2, the compatibility of the UK CFC regime was considered in the context of a closure notice application that was made to the Tax Tribunal. And that matter proceeded to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal was content with that approach, which is suggestive that what was being proposed by the First Tier Tribunal was acceptable. In relation to Vodafone 2, the First Tier Tribunal said, well, there's no direct application. Vodafone 2 was a strict question of law, i.e. compatibility of UK CFC regime, whereas the present case, Mr. Henk's case, concerned a mixed question of law and fact. But in fact, there was no distinction in principle between the threshold question of law, which was issue in Vodafone 2, and the threshold mixed question of law and fact here. What is key in relation to each of those is that both were questions that produce a binary answer that is capable of bringing the proceedings to a close. If the decision of the tribunal was that Mr. Henk's was not UK domiciled, then obviously there'd be no reason for him to provide the information and his inquiry could be closed. It also noted that this is a question, i.e. domicile, that a specialist tax tribunal is perfectly capable of answering. The First Tribunal then went on to consider objections and to consider whether or not there are any reasons for not following the proposed procedure, the procedure that's been proposed by Mr. Henk's. And as I said, issue of estoppel was the reason why the First Tier Tribunal took a different view in the Levy case. And so it looked at that in some detail. And in Levy, the parties proceeded on the basis that any decision that the First Tier Tribunal made in the course of closure notice proceedings in relation to domicile would not bind HMRC in issuing their closure notice or the First Tier Tribunal in any subsequent appeal. And that it made reference to the Kafour case. And the reason for that is the very narrow approach to issue estoppel and the meaning of issue in the context of two different contexts, an appeal and procedural points. And in Levy, the First Tier Tribunal refused the application of partial closure notice following the Kafour line of authority. However, Mr. Henk's submission was that the decision would be binding on HMRC and on the First Tier Tribunal in any subsequent appeal against the closure notice. And the First Tier Tribunal concluded actually that the key issue is not, to an extent, issue of estoppel. It is, in fact, an abusive process. And that's a much broader, it's a much more flexible doctrine in terms of how it looks at. It looks at the justice of the situation rather than just simply whether or not it's the particular issue which has been determined by the court. And it concluded that, in particular, that broader doctrine of abusive process meant that the domicile issue could not be relitigated. The next reason that the First Tribunal put forward as a reason why it could not follow this approach was the information notices and as to looking at the context of domicile and how that arose in the context of the information notices. The First Tribunal concluded that it could address and determine the threshold question of domicile first and then go on to consider whether the information is reasonably required. So having considered its view that it could do this and the reasons for it not being able to do so were not sufficient to stop it, it then went on to the next question, which is that having concluded it could do this, should it exercise its power? Clearly, this is similar to any preliminary issue. The tribunal has a discretion to do this. It's not obliged to do this. And it needed to determine whether or not it should exercise its discretion to do so. It made particular reference to the Beneficial House case in 2017. And it looked at the various factors pro and against exercising its discretion in favour of this approach proposed by Mr. Hanks. And it raised 4 points. First, there was a balance between the right of HMRC to ensure that it has the armoury to pursue investigations and the right of the appellant to be protected from undue delay in closing the inquiries. It noted that HMRC's inquiries have been ongoing for over 3 years. The taxpayer had been put to a considerable amount of trouble and expense in answering numerous questions about his domicile. And finally, the question of Mr. Hanks' domicile was effectively the sole issue that had to be resolved to conclude matters. And having reviewed those and having reviewed the factors pro and against, let's just summarise, the First Tier Tribunal concluded that it was appropriate for it to determine the taxpayer's domicile in the context of those applications. Having reached the conclusion that it could and it should look at domicile, the tribunal then sent out the legal test, which is that in order to have acquired a UK domicile, the taxpayer must, at some point prior to the relevant tax year, have 1, had his only or chief residence in the UK, and 2, formed the intention to remain in the UK indefinitely. And the First Tier Tribunal applied those tests to Mr. Hanks' particular factual circumstances, and it reached the following conclusions. First, the taxpayer's chief residence was in the UK. He did have another residence, but that other residence, which was in Spain, was visited infrequently and only on a seasonal basis. He had no strong links or attachments to any jurisdiction other than the UK. He did have strong connections with the UK in terms of his wife and family. He gave evidence in terms of his retirement plans and when he would leave the UK, but overall there were significant uncertainties in relation to the fixedness and the clarity of the circumstances that would cause Mr. Hanks to leave the UK. So having reviewed all those factors, having reviewed the evidence, the tribunal concluded that on balance, and it was a close decision, but on balance, Mr. Hanks had acquired the UK domicile of choice. So what, in fact, was the First Tier Tribunal's decision? Well, the First Tier Tribunal's decision was that HMRC had reasonable grounds for not issuing a closure notice in relation to each of those tax years in issue, and that the information requested by HMRC in the information notice were reasonably required. The extent to which the issue of Mr. Hanks' domicile is going to arise again in relation to those decisions is somewhat unclear. We now have the Hanks decision and the Levy decision, which go in different ways. There's also a third First Air Tribunal case, the Berikos case, and that is being heard on appeal by the Upper Tribunal, I believe, in October this year. And I think it's fair to say that whatever happens, at least one of Hanks and Levy has been decided incorrectly, or at least the procedural approach will not be favoured. And so what happens next with regard to Mr. Hanks' case is likely to be determined by decision at the Upper Tribunal in the Berikos case, which, as I said, I believe is going to be heard in October this year. So again, I think this is one where we have to watch this space. So that is the final case, and I hope you enjoyed listening to the presentations in respect to those cases. Thank you.